Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 261 for the week of May 22nd, 2024. Azure will continue until further notice, unfortunately. Good evening, Matt and Ryan. How's it going?
I was not expecting the unfortunate coming into that.
I had to keep you on your toes.
I'd be in trouble if Azure just shut down for my day job.
I mean, it's Microsoft. At least give you 2 years notice. And then you'll have a little bit of time.
I mean, killed by Google is a thing too, so you know.
Yeah. I mean, again, if you're Unisuper in Australia, your whole thing just turned off. So
No big deal.
All right. Well, let's jump into the news because this week was build, man, and there's a bunch of build news. So we got to talk about Azure a bunch. So let's get to it. But first, by doing a detour into AWS, Amazon plans to spend 7.8 billion euros in the AWS European Sovereign Cloud set to launch by the end of 2025. They basically want you to know the roadmap so you can start planning and working with your partners. The first AWS European Sovereign Cloud is planning to launch its first AWS region in the state of Brandenburg, Germany, by the end of 2025. Available to all AWS customers, this is an effort backed by the 7.8 billion euro investment in infrastructure, jobs, and skills development. And customers will get the full power of AWS architecture, expansive service portfolio, and APIs that customers use and love today. Customers can start building applications in any existing region and simply move them to AWS European Sovereign Cloud when the first region launches in 2025. Now, that's an interesting statement, because if you mean that you're going to give me an easy button that just magically moves my stuff from one region to another, can you just make that available globally to all regions? Because that would be amazing and it would save me a ton of time. But if you mean the thing where we take Terraform, we update it for the new region, and then we do a really expensive ETL job where we migrate our data over and pay you egress fees, and then do a Terraform destroy of the old environment, then screw you, Amazon. Screw you.
I wish my workloads were easy enough to where it was, the reality of build and then just move it and redeploy it in the new region. It's like there's persistent environment data, there's stuff like a direct connect that you have to port over. There's all kinds of things that would be difficult to move from region to region, I imagine, unless they've made
some S3 buckets, databases, caches, queues, all those fun filled things. Because God knows that you've never hard coded anything into your application by accident.
Never happens.
Never.
I mean, to that exercise, then I fully recommend this, because that's the only way you find those things and fix them.
This is why we're all masochists.
It's true.
I mean, Azure actually does have a decent way you can move stuff between regions and subscriptions. There are a bunch of limitations around some of it, but it is a nice feature I have looked at using a few times for that reason. So it would be nice if AWS had the ability to move stuff in that way.
So many opportunities that we could do it.
Yeah. So. It just seems so anti what they're trying to set up with the sovereign region to begin with, right? Like, I guess copying data is fine in, but not out. Like, it's like GovCloud, right? It's completely separate. So strange. That's a strange.
Oh, is this the EU GovCloud essentially version?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's basically EU GovCloud.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. I'm a little slow since we're recording late tonight.
It's okay. Well, anyways, we'll see if that actually turns out to be a tool. I have been working with some other people because I posted about it in another Slack channel with the last week in AWS people. And so Corey and I are actually partnering up on this. He's going to go talk to some product managers and get back to me on this, because I was like, if this is a thing, I don't think it is. I think it's maybe a press release written by Q is I think what probably this was. And so we'll see where this ends up here shortly. We'll follow up with you guys next week on that as we get our answers.
The promise of the cloud, right? Just be able to move it around.
Seamlessly click.
Between all the clouds, just move it. What could possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong moving from a commercial region to a highly secure government region? In a sovereign cloud.
I can't imagine anything.
I'm sure every feature that you have in commercial is available in GovCloud, in the government clouds right away.
Sure.
Ran into weird APIs that just don't work for strange reason because that one feature isn't there.
And it's not like, in America, FedRAMP is actually saying they don't like GovClouds anymore and that they're mad about GovCloud and they want to go away from GovCloud. So, there's that too. Minor difficulties.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you're living this world where you only can support IPv6, which I don't know who you are, but cool for you, you no longer have to pay for those pesky IPv4 addresses on your application load balancer, as you can now deploy an IPv6 only application load balancer. So stop paying those pesky IPv4 fees and only deliver traffic to mobile devices, I guess, is how that would work.
So the trick is for internal, the reason why we're starting to see this more and more is that because you can address these huge spaces in IPv6, they're not doing the equivalent of RFC 1918 address space. So that's why these things become super important, because they'll configure an internal sort of networking path that's only IPv6, mm-hmm. but then you can't use like a managed load balancer or something like that, because there's no IP space. And so, yeah, it's kind of interesting, but then I'm curious on well, so many of our patterns are based on non-routable things. So it's an interesting challenge, I think.
There is a non-routable IPv6 space, isn't there?
I thought so, but then I was like, maybe I just made that assumption.
I made the assumption, but... Mm-hmm.
Yes, unique local addresses are ULAs, and they start at FC00:/7. Basically they're equivalent of 10.0/8 and 172.16/12 and 192.168.0/16. So there you go. It exists. Mm-hmm. Again, my IPv6 math is still rough, so I can't do subnetting.
I mean, my IPv4 subnet math was never good. So,
oh, come on. Can't you just pull out what like a /21 is out of things out of thin air? Come on.
I have three tools I can use that I can answer that question with. But yeah, no, 100%.
Best was when I figured out how to use the Terraform CIDR. Was it the CIDR, subnet CIDR calculator? Mm-hmm. Where it just does magical things. And I was like, this is cool. Don't fully understand it still. And I think.
Don't care.
I think someone has explained it to me like 10 times. I'm like, it worked. I'm never touching the network again. Just leave it.
Yeah. The MCAC 4.0 test I took many, many moons ago in 1998, 99, maybe 2000. I don't know. Somewhere in there. The part I was most worried about the MCAC test was the subnetting part, because one of the four books you had to read and learn was subnetting in the networking part. And, yeah. So that was
in the beta of the AWS networking exam. I took at reInvent 1 year, and there was like five questions about doing, and like you had to like figure out subnet math. And I'm like, I am not awake enough. We are in Vegas, and I'm not remembering how to do subnet math on the fly right now.
And no one does it. No one does it in their head, anyways. Like,
not correctly.
That's why I got bumped from the real exam.
That's good. That's good.
And then I never actually took the networking professional exam again, because why bother? Yep. That was good.
Well, I have a product for you guys today that has been renamed now three times. You may remember a little product called Amazon WorkLink. Came out a while back, and then it was rebranded to Amazon Workspace Web. And now it's Amazon Workspace Secure Browser. So with Workspace Secure Browser, users can access private websites and SaaS web applications, interact with online resources, or browse the internet from a disposable container. The service helps reduce the risk of data exfiltration by streaming web content. No HTML, DOM, or sensitive company data is transmitted to the local machine. It's all sent via the browser as images, basically.
What's funny is I thought this service was called something else to begin with, too.
It was WorkLink to begin with. I chased it back today because I was like, wasn't there something like WorkLink or something? And I went and Googled it, and I was like, oh. And then you could like go to the Amazon WorkLink product page. It goes right to this Workspace browser. I was like, ah, okay.
I did this with AppStream and just streaming just Chrome through it. So this is definitely a more direct path. But like, I think I did all that before WorkLink/WorkWeb. Work, secure browser, whatever combination of words they want to throw in there together, existed.
I assume AppStream is still around, because AppStream is kind of a different technology. It's more like...
I loved AppStream.
I'm going to date myself by calling it Citrix MetaFrame, but it's not. It's basically like a Citrix thin client for web app or for apps. Yeah, it still exists. AppStream 2.0.
Yeah, I love it. Still there. It was... Yeah.
It's good for a thick client stuff.
I think it's one of those hidden features. I think it's one of those really good hidden features of Azure. It's stream this one application, and especially in like secure environments, you know, healthcare, anything along those lines, stream it, you can isolate it and just stream a very specific piece of network, you know, traffic. So I thought it was always a good service. So it took out a lot of the heavy lifting that I've done many times for people.
I'll have to go figure out what the difference is between AppStream and this workspace.
AppStream can do many different applications.
Mm-hmm. Where this can only do web apps.
This is only web.
Oh, okay.
So you could stream, for example, calculator if you wanted to via AppStreams.
So at our prior life, where we had a really persnickety security department who wouldn't allow us to put things like Jira and GitHub on the internet, this was, I think I told you about this when it first announced. I was like, we'd use this for Jira. And you were like, yeah, I'm not going to get that approved by security. I'm like, no, probably not, but it would work. I didn't get that at that point. But I had a guest spot on a very popular AWS podcast called Screaming in the Clouds with Corey Quinn. Last week, I was the guest, and I talked about Google Cloud Next. We talked about AI and the disaster of AI, and it was just a good conversation. We talked about a bunch of different things, including the leadership changes at Amazon before they actually were announced, because I was giving him, you know, hypothetical, like, you know, how do you think Andy and Adam are doing? And then, you know, we recorded that, and then last week, right before we dropped the episode, it basically became true that Adam was leaving. So that was sort of weird coincidence that I knew nothing about in advance, I swear, and neither did Corey. And I messaged him when that happened. I was like, I did not know. I swear to you. And he didn't know either, so that was good. But so it's a good episode. Definitely check it out. He puts their stuff on YouTube. Maybe we should put our stuff on YouTube. People can message us if they watch us on YouTube. We do republish the audio to YouTube today, and we get a few listeners that way. But we don't do video there. But if people want to see us on video, we can talk about it. Message us on our Slack or email me at...
It is the trend. It is
Justin at the Cloud Pod. Yeah, it is a total trend, and I don't listen to podcasts that way, so... But if our listeners want it, I would, you know, our platform supports it. We could do it.
I was going to say, it will be, where in the world is each one of us? Because I swear one of us is somewhere random at least every week or every other week.
I mean, people can start playing games on Twitter like, oh, I was in Ryan's background. He's got like a weird travel case. Like
geolocator. Yeah. But yeah. I love it. I love it.
Yeah. Great. All right. Moving on to GCP. The FinOps Hub is now generally available. The service allows you to supercharge your FinOps practices and optimize costs with intelligent insights and actionable recommendations. The general availability includes the ability to right-size resources, reduce waste, and optimize rates with CUDs, so you can invest those savings directly into other innovations like AI. FinOps Hub, comprehensive cloud optimization suite, is designed to solve the biggest challenges faced by your FinOps team, and it blends rate and usage strategies with personalized subscriptions tailored to your business needs. Plus, you can track your accomplishments with an easy-to-use realized savings ledger, which of all the things this thing does, the realized savings ledger, I think, is probably the coolest feature of all of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many times I've worked with teams to bring down their costs. And then, you know, there's another major initiative and they're like, how much penny pinching do you expect me to do? Right. And then versus other teams who barely make any effort and are applying the same things. And so the ability to sort of call out teams and see that savings is amazing.
That's always the hard part of, you know, when you work with teams and you have to keep going back. Like you said, how do you penny pinch more and more? Because you reach a point when it's not worth it.
Yeah.
The minor changes you're going to make, or it's a major platform re-architectural change from, you know, insert technology A to technology B. And the only way to do it is going to be thousands of man hours. So,
yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of like people who complain about NAT gateway costs. And it's like, yes, you can replace a NAT gateway with your own managed infrastructure of EC2 instances and route your traffic through that and all of that. And then I think about it, I'm like, you know, like in my spend, it's like a rounding error. Yeah.
Yeah. Never stood up my own. Yeah.
Now, would I do it for my personal account where I'm cheap as cheap and I pinch every penny I spend on my Amazon account? Yes, 100% I would do it there. If I didn't just put everything in public zones, but you know,
I definitely don't have things in public zone in my own personal AWS account either.
So yeah, there's options. You know, people have different scales. You know, some people say $8 million is not worth optimizing for, and other people are like, that would save our company's life. So you know, it's all relative to your spend. Google is excited to announce their seamless integration of Ray, a powerful distributed Python framework with Google Cloud Vertex AI, is now generally available. This integration empowers AI developers to effortlessly scale their AI workloads on Vertex AI's versatile infrastructure, which unlocks the full potential of machine learning, data processing, and distributed computing. Ray's distributed computing framework gives you a unified experience for both generative AI and predictive AI, which seamlessly integrates with Vertex AI's infrastructure capability. A unified development experience gives you an easy way to transition from interactive prototyping on local dev or in a Vertex AI collaborative enterprise space to production deployments on Vertex AI managed infrastructure with minimal code changes. It includes enterprise-grade security, including service controls, private service connect, and customer-managed encryption keys.
All I can hear when reading this is just the cha-ching sound. Like, it's like, there's only one thing more expensive than, you know, training your AI models, and that's doing these very large data processing jobs. And so you abstract that away where you can do both in a very, like, just click of a button framework. Cool. That is going to get expensive. But I'm sure the experience is worth it. But
as long as you're not paying the bill at the other end.
As long as you're not paying the bill. It is sort of funny, though. I'm finding more and more as they're releasing more studio sort of, you know, studio and no code and a lot of management sort of services around AI, like we've seen in machine learning, like the more I'm just going back and like, I just want the basics. I don't need your complex data, like ETL workflow to build, to automatically update the model, to do the thing.
Like, I mean, you're just angry at yelling at cloud though. So I get it.
It's it's been a theme this week for me. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Come on, Ryan. Are you not an LLMs ops person? As you know, is it dev LLM ops, I think is, yeah, or whatever it's now called?
I mean, it would be if I liked any of the patterns, but no.
I thought you were going to say if you liked any of the letters involved with what I just said.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of, like, I think we're reaching the end of the transformer model era. Like, they're going to keep getting bigger and more, you know, more contacts and more tokens, and you know, then there's gonna be a point where like the return on these investments is going to depreciate very quickly, and I think then we're all be like, well, what's after transformer? Because, you know, that only did one thing and now we need more things. So we'll see how that works out over time. Google is letting us know they're named as a member of the Gartner Magic Quadrant for SIEM, but they're not a leader, they're just a visionary, which, you know, kind of surprising a little bit with them owning Mandiant. This is a very crowded quadrant, though. And in general, Google is nearing the line of being able to go into the leaders quadrant, but just misses the mark against companies like Splunk, Microsoft, IBM, Secure Onyx, and Xbeam. I just want to point out that AWS nor Oracle is in this magic quadrant. So, you know, just Microsoft and Google standing alone. Google gets a high marks for its ease of use query language, capabilities, and flexible cost model, but low marks for it being only a SaaS product, reporting only being provided by Looker and its complicated end-user business behavior analytics capabilities. Microsoft scored high marks with Sentinel, with strengths being its tightly integrated ecosystem, customizable solution, and MITRE attack coverage, but cautions it has an over-reliance on Azure, limited out-of-the-box compliance reporting, and it's only a SaaS product as well.
All those things are 100% factual about Microsoft Sentinel.
This only available as a SaaS product is a weird, like, I guess in the security space where people are still really concerned about that kind of stuff, that makes sense to be a concern or a caution for those products, but it's sort of odd to see in 2024, oh, it's a SaaS product, that's a risk. So I did see Elasticsearch is on this list as a visionary as well.
Yeah, yep. AWS isn't even on here, and I was thinking about it. I was like, I don't even know what their SIEM solution is.
They don't have one. It's called Partners.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Maybe at reInvent, Reinforce in 4 weeks, they'll have something, but they don't.
I think that's a very specific choice. Like, you know, they've resisted adding that functionality into their, like, Inspector and Guard Duty, and they are really focused on that end of the pipeline. It's clear. And so I don't think we'll see that announced, which is weird. It is strange.
Yeah. I mean, Amazon's always been really big about security comes from partners, and that's been kind of the way the cloud has always been for them, is that security capabilities comes from partners, not from their own internal stuff.
They've slowly been knocking down that door, I feel like, with Inspector and Guard Duty. And
I mean, they've added basic things, but a lot of those products extend with using third parties. So Yes, it's Inspector, but you subscribe to signatures from Palo Alto or from so like they do a few things, but they do kind of pull in other parts of it.
Yeah, but, Wrath is the same way too, with like the managed rules from you know, any of the vendors or stuff like that. But yeah.
So last week, Google announced over 100 things at I/O. Most of them included AI. And since we already talked about most of that last week, I did scan through this to see some of the highlights here. And there's a couple of things I thought we should mention. Project Astra is their new vision for future of AI assistants. And if you know what an AI assistant is, you might want to check that out because it's kind of cool. A bunch of stuff for Android and a bajillion AI integrations. Project IDX, which is their new integrated developer experience for full-stack multi-platform apps, is now open for everyone to use. And Firebase has released Firebase Data Connect, a new way for developers to use SQL with Firebase. So Firebase has now graduated to be a true NoSQL database because it supports SQL.
That should have been our show title.
That's the test, yeah.
Yep, that's my rule. Mm-hmm. Ironically, at work, there was a new enterprise architecture standard thing, and someone said something about... well, you know, we should really start forcing NoSQL solutions before we support, you know, force RDBMS. And I was like, well, I mean, as long as they support SQL, I'm fine. So that means if it's a real one, even at work, day job, I use that joke. all right. Azure is here with a ton of news, which is unusual for Azure because normally it's all about AI. But this week it's about AI and other AI and then some other stuff. So we'll talk about all of it here as we jump into it. First up, something I didn't realize was limited has been extended. So Compute Reservations Exchange for Azure Virtual Machine, Azure Dedicated Host, and Azure App Service has been extended until further notice. Apparently, it was originally going to go away on January 1st, 2024, which was many months ago. And so apparently, this is still just kept working, and people are like in limbo of, is it going to stay around? Is it deprecated? And so they're now pleased to tell you that you may exchange compute reservations for different instance series and regions until they notify you of the change again, which will be at least 6 months in advance. In addition, any compute reservations purchased during this extended grace period will retain the right to one or more exchanges after the grace period ends. And basically, when you read into the details of all of this, Azure is much nicer than either Google or AWS, is that you don't have to do an exception to get your instance types changed. So when they announce the new Shiny C7 instances and you have savings plans for C5s, you can now swap those out. Amazon's solution to that was, we'll just go to savings plans. You just buy on a dollar situation versus on instance types. But Azure didn't follow that model and now gives the ability
to go
this way.
Oh, they have both models. I mean, it's just like AWS is where it's more savings if you choose the exact instance types or virtual machine types, but they do have the savings plans, which does go across virtual machines and their app services if you're in a certain level, like a P3 or above, I think. So like there's some nuances there. But yeah. They have the same thing that AWS has.
Yeah.
Just to make life more complicated.
Of course. I mean, in GCP land, we have CUDs, flex CUDs, and same idea. So,
yeah.
In public preview, you can now change the capacity model on Azure Cosmos DB account from serverless to provision capacity in place. So it means you don't have to destroy and rebuild it. Thanks. Appreciate that.
That's awesome.
Wish that was just a launch feature.
Yeah. I'd like to see more of, serverless offerings go to this model just because it is sort of. A lot of them are like, we offer a serverless solution, doesn't really truly scale down to zero. And then if you want to adopt it, it's recreate your entire database. So
this is also nice for like, hey, you've launched this new feature. It's not really used yet, or it's behind like a feature flag in your product. Okay, now it's getting used and we want to keep it up all the time with provisioning capacity. So like, to me, this is also like a good onboarding ramp of like, it's all here. It's all there. So you're not just paying for nothing day one out of the gate.
Yeah, it gives you a chance to try it in dev, see if it works, and then scale as necessary without having to do a bunch of work.
Yeah, make your dev into prod. Definitely never ends badly too.
Yeah. Well, Microsoft is giving you AI in your personal PC with the latest and greatest Copilot Plus PCs. These are PCs designed for the world of AI and Copilot. Hopi PCs are the fastest and most intelligent Windows PCs ever built, with new silicon capabilities of incredible 40-plus TOPS, which I didn't really describe what it was, all-day battery, and access to the most advanced models. Copilot PCs will enable you to do things you can't do on any other PC, like have a button that says Copilot. This basically sums down to Microsoft is launching an ARM-based Surface computer again, which they tried once before and failed horribly. So we're trying it again, and this time with Copilot to make it work. So they're also leveraging Snapdragon, Qualcomm chips for this, and other things as well. So,
this announcement's strange to me because it's, but I mean, I find most Copilot announcement strange, so maybe that's just me.
I mean, it's really just a Surface announcement hidden, you know, made secretly look like an AI announcement.
Yeah,
and really they're just, you know, it's two new Surface Pros and Surface laptops, and then a bunch of partners who are announcing they're going to support the Copilot button on their laptops as well, and they're going to have a special designation or sticker that says Copilot Plus on them. That's all it really is at the end of the day. Just Microsoft being marketing like Windows inside, Intel inside, you know, kind of stuff again.
Wasn't there like Windows 7 compatible for years and stuff like that? That's what I feel like this is.
That's what this sort of is, yeah. And it has a button that says Copilot on it, so, or it has a little Copilot symbol, which is a weird window-y thing. But yeah, I mean, like the other thing, interesting idea is that this was designed purposely to beat the MacBook Airs, the 13 and 11 inches. Which are, you know, they basically said our processor is much faster than the M3 MacBook Airs that are out today. And I'm like, yeah, but they just announced M4s 2 weeks ago. So you're already behind, Microsoft. Well done.
Do you know what's more old school than blowing on a Nintendo cartridge to make it work? Manually creating individual policies to achieve least privilege in your cloud. Leave old habits in the past, and with a single click, lock down access to sensitive permissions and services without disrupting DevOps. With the new Cloud Permissions Firewall from Sunry Security, you can easily restrict excessive permissions from human and machine identities, quarantine unused identities, and restrict specific regions and unused services with a click of a button. Start a 14-day free trial for Sunry's Cloud Permissions Firewall at sunry.co/cloudpod. That's sonrai.co/cloudpod.
We're tracking the rollout of Kubernetes version 1.3 support across the managed Kubernetes platforms. GKE was up first a couple weeks ago, and now Azure is here with public preview of 1.3 support in AKS. So Amazon, you're last once again.
Not last. Mm. So the question is, where's Oracle fall on the spectrum? We're going to find the Oracle announcement.
I don't really track that one from Oracle, but maybe I'll add to the list. I'll keep an eye on it. General available today is Azure Functions can now run on Azure Container Apps. This is ability to deploy your container app environment for multi-type services to a cloud-native solution designed for centralized management and serverless scale. Azure Functions host runtime extensions and Azure Function apps can be developed and deployed as containers using familiar functions tooling, including core tools, AZ CLI, portal, code to cloud with GitHub Actions and DevOps takes into the container apps compute environment. So that's available if you want to run your Azure Functions as just normal containers, because you want to run them on-prem or you want to run them other places that don't support functions natively. You can now make that portable across both the cloud and your other environments.
Well, is it actually that, or is it more of like the application management? Like, that's what I wasn't sure, because I don't use the service, but like a lot of management of serverless struggles with like the sort of ecosystem of it. Like, how do you update and how do you roll out versions and you know, some of the things that have been around in like, you know, Beanstalk forever.
It sort of feels like they now support kind of like a Knative type deployment model for their functions on top of managed container infrastructure of some kind.
Yeah. So before, I think it was, and I'm not 100% sure because we don't use this service, but I do use function apps, where we launch our function apps in app environments, app service environments. So it's all tied to the app service world. So this is taking the app functions and launching them directly in the app, in the Azure Container App service instead. So you're able to essentially run a Lambda now in two different places, depending on what other infrastructure you have set up. So if you're already leveraging app service plans and like you have managed app service plans, so think like you have told AWS I need X number of CPU and servers to run all my Lambda functions, you can now also run them in just the container form instead. So I think your ECS or EKS cluster. I think. I give that about an 80% probability if I got all those all the app services, app environments, app service plans, and all that correct.
Yeah.
Tell me where I'm wrong.
Yeah, we'll let you know. Well, if you weren't confused about how to run Azure Functions on container apps, you can also now deploy Azure Compute Fleets in preview. This is a new service that streamlines the provisioning and management of Azure Compute capacity across different VM types, availability zones, and pricing models to achieve desired scale, performance, and cost. Azure Compute Fleet provides customers with many features to deploy and manage a diverse group of VMs at scale, and those features include integration of multiple pricing models within a single fleet, automated configuration of fleets of VMs to achieve the best mix of VM sizes, pricing models, and performance based on current capacity available on the Azure cloud, adjustable settings to prioritize the deployment speed, operational cost, or balance of both, capability to manage and deploy up to 10,000 VMs in a region with a single fleet, and numerous options that allow users to automatically and programmatically control how fleets respond to changing variables such as cost overruns, capacity shortages, or specific VM sizes, or the eviction of spot VMs.
I just love how this kind of works across everything. So you can have it handle spot and on-demand in different sizes. Like having that single pane of glass to kind of manage all the different levers that you need really just makes life easier if you're managing a fleet of a large size.
Yeah. I mean, these are fantastic when you're trying to, you know, scale down, but not quite all the way down, right? So you want to be able to burst capacity, but you don't necessarily want to have nothing. So you, or the opposite, right? Where you want to have sort of spot fleet, but then if it gets too volatile, you want to have something a little bit more resilient. So I like these enablements because it just makes that so much easier to manage.
When they GA this, I'll look at implementing it at my day job just because there's definitely some easy places that we can save some money by saying, hey, we need 50% of these on demand and I need, you know, 100% of spot and it still will be cheaper than running 100% on demand, even with having an extra 50% capacity light sitting around.
Yeah, I remember when Amazon rolled this out, I was super excited about it. I've used it actually a little bit in a couple projects here and there. It's got some, you know, at least the way Amazon implemented it has some rough edges.
Yeah, but, I was going to say.
Yeah. I think I worked with you guys on one of those.
Yeah, mostly by swearing.
Yeah.
I definitely remember we rolled this out somewhere and Ryan and I had a very long night of swearing at the computer over something at one point.
Oh, yeah, no, we built our own version of that. Mm-hmm. And then
no, I remember that too. Yeah. That's Justin's fault.
Yes, that is.
Yeah, but that was awesome. but no, I do remember you guys cursing that out quite heavily, and then I've used it on a couple other projects where I needed to provide, you know, some really spot instances. And you know, the challenge that if you are doing a lot with spot instances now on Amazon is if it's an instance type that could potentially be used for model training, the spot market dries up really quickly for certain instance types. So you have to really deploy fleets now for spot to really be have any level of reliability and uptime. And so I've had to use it a couple times now, and it's still problematic, I would say, but not as problematic as it was many years ago when we first tried it.
Yeah.
What it's I do like about a lot of these spot, you know, and which sounds terrible, but the spot market's drying up and things like that, is that it means there's not just all this waste sitting out there. And from like a eco perspective, it means that we are starting to actually utilize all of it. And so AWS and all the hyperscalers aren't over provisioning by so much now that people are actually able to leverage all these compute types out there.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when you think about, you know, the amount of electricity and resources that it takes, if we can get to that utilization down, like, or versus the, you know, the overall utilization over capacity rather, that's fantastic. You know, and I thought the spot market was genius when they announced it because they just monetized their spare capacity, which is
what AWS was to start off, kind of.
Yeah. And then, you know, now, yeah, with the volatility we're seeing, it's because people are taking advantage of it. And there's a lot of really spiky, burstable workloads now that used to just be run on compute that was just sitting there burning money. So, yeah.
Well, rare. Another thing is Amazon and, you know, Google and maybe Azure too. Yeah, they've made a lot more tools now making it easy to access spot. So, I mean, like accessing a spot fleet from inside of SageMaker or Vertex is like, oh, I just want a spot fleet and run this job when you can. And when there's no capacity available in spot market, then don't run it. And, you know, so you have a lot more flexibility now take advantage of these things without having to think about, you know, other parts of your app that have to require the ability to get killed at any time.
Yeah, it used to be a lot harder to adopt Spot in a way that, you know, wasn't going to end up with your application on the floor somewhere. So yeah, now it's Clickbox. You know, it's either going to be cheap or it's not. We'll see.
Which is great. I mean, the Spot blocks were great that AWS came out with. Give me a server for 6 hours, guaranteed. You know, I think Azure, might have something similar to it, but I'm not sure. You know, so like, it just enabling all these like little different ways to go test something, it just helps everyone out, you know, and makes life easier. It makes your CFO not get mad at you in life, which is always a good thing.
As much. There's never a I'm never going to be on the good side of a CFO. It's never going to happen.
I mean, you probably are one of the largest cost centers.
Yeah, you're a cost center, right? That's okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Microsoft Build continues. This is day two. There may be more tomorrow or Thursday. We'll cover that next week because that's after recording. But so today was big keynotes. So lots of interesting announcements. Yesterday was the Copilot PC we already talked about. But first up, this today was real-time intelligence with Microsoft Fabric is in preview, which can help be helpful for analysts with simple, low, no-code experiences, and can also benefit pro developers with code-rich user interfaces to make all of your real-time intelligence needs easier. There's a new workload development kit in Fabric, making it possible for developers and application developers to extend applications with Fabric to create a unified user experience. The GitHub Copilot extensions allow developers and organizations to customize their GitHub Copilot experiences with preferred services like Azure, Docker, Sentry, and more directly within Copilot Chat for GitHub. Using extensions like GitHub Copilot for Azure, for example, developers can explore and manage Azure resources while also troubleshooting issues and locating relevant logs and code directly from the Azure console in your Copilot extension. Microsoft and Cognition signed a partnership, bringing their autonomous AI software agent, Devin, to customers to help with complex tasks such as code migration and modernization projects. And that'll be available to you in the LM Studio. There's two new instance types, including the Azure NDMI 300X V5 from AMD for training and inference needs, as well as the Cobalt 100 ARM-based VMs in preview. The Cobalt 100 ARM-based virtual machines are custom silicon designed by Microsoft. So if you're looking for that sweet, sweet, sweet ARM goodness on Microsoft, you have some preview instances of those. The new Team Copilot, for those of you who are suffering with Copilot like I do, with Teams like I do, is a new expansion to Microsoft 365. You'll be able to invoke Copilot where you collaborate in Teams, Loop, Planner, and more. Team Copilot can be a meeting facilitator, managing the agenda, tracking times, and taking notes. It can act as a collaborator in chats by surfacing important information, tracking action items, and addressing unresolved issues. And then Microsoft Copilot Studio is a new agent capability empowering developers to build Copilots that can provide proactive response to data and events, all today on the main stage. I watched about 10 minutes of the keynote and I lost interest and turned it off.
I will say I did not watch it, but I am planning on trying to watch it without swearing too much at it. So,
I mean, I'm all for the Teams Copilot because I think that's a great use of AI. Like, you know, every time, like in a past job where we've instrumented like the meeting counter where it just counts how expensive this meeting is by the attendees. Like I would love, I'd love that functionality in here. But unfortunately, I imagine that just like most of the other Copilot offerings, it's going to be so expensive that it's going to be prohibitive to use just so that I could not pay attention to meetings and have it summarized at the end.
The integration into Loop and other things is kind of interesting that I would like to see that really expand. You know, I think that the M365 Copilot is interesting. I play with it a little bit at work, but I haven't figured out how to actually use it to make my life be exponentially better yet, which is what they tell me it should be.
What is Loop? Is that the Canva competitor?
It's their collaboration tool, I believe. I think it's one of those things that's been renamed a few times. Hold on. Don't make me wrong. Loop supports 50 people editing a workspace at a time, blocks of collaborative text and content that can live independently, copy and paste, and share freely. Google Docs, Word, but like more for like just collaboration during a meeting is the way I've seen it used.
So it's competitive with Word, but not Word?
I think it's kind of like if you merged like a
OneNote
wiki
and Word together
and a OneNote.
Yeah. It's kind of, I think it's like the OneNote replacement, I feel like.
And the Reminders app, or is that Apple or whatever, the Tasks app?
Yeah.
I wonder if this is like, you know, for a long time there was those collaboration platforms that sort of died out and they've all been purchased and rolled in.
Interesting. I've never used this thing.
Yeah, me either.
If one of my employees loves it and uses it for like, because you know, versus like keeping like a bunch of stuff in Confluence of like the next step of things that he needs to, you know, talk to different people about. He just has like a tab per person and it's an easy place for him to dump stuff versus like dumping it into a Confluence or, you know, somewhere else along those lines.
I mean, just playing with it for 2 seconds here, I would say it's never going to replace OneNote for me because it doesn't let me just put text anywhere in a sheet, which is the OneNote killer feature for me. It mimics how I write on paper. Okay, cool. Maybe we'll play with this some more. I have it licensed for our .org. All right. Expanding extensibility in Azure development environments will now deliver more seamless experience to customers, enabling them to leverage popular infrastructure as code frameworks quickly and easily with the extensibility model and perform customized deployments based on their organizational needs. And when they say popular infrastructure as code frameworks, they mean things like ARM and Bicep and Terraform, which you all know, and now Pulumi. And so since Pulumi is the last standing, you know, infrastructure as code vendor, since Terraform's not been bought by IBM, Pulumi makes sense. And then I was like, what's ARM and Bicep? And I was like, oh yeah, those are the Azure ones that no one uses.
Those are the built-in, yeah.
ARM is CloudFormation, Bicep is CDK.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. That's a good analogy.
Bicep actually I've played with a little bit isn't bad. I just prefer Terraform because I can use it across everything, you know, versus Bicep is still just Azure
specific. Yeah, why learn something that's Azure specific? I mean, I'm sort of intrigued to maybe learn more about Pulumi since Terraform is not part of IBM and who knows what's going to happen to it. But then OpenTofu exists, I suppose. So then Vault can be replaced by OpenBow. So
Pulumi I played with years ago, like when it was really early, and it seemed fine, but it was more of a programming language than Terraform is.
Yeah, it's a lot more like a CDK
or
Bicep than sort of a configuration of code. And I've never been able to adopt that pattern well. And I think that's, you know, my old man yelling at the cloud showing.
You just gotta get your Python. You just get your Python out and define things in abstract ways, and then CDK will do magic, and then you'll like it. But
that's the thing. I've tried. I've deployed lots of things using CDK, trying to sort of make it work, and like trying to think about. It's really great from a developer perspective when it's just me working on a thing, and I want to deploy it to my. I love CDK for that. When I try to think about building a developer platform or collaborating across multiple teams in a large org, no, hard no.
Yeah, no.
Right. Yeah, and that's really where I run into those limitations, just because you turn into this, you know, where you're constantly in this test cycle. If you don't have anything explicitly defined, you're testing sort of the outputs, like a unit test. And so with any kind of CDK, you need to give it inputs and test the outputs, and you end up doing a lot of testing to do that at scale. So it's kind of tricky.
What I have always wanted is almost like unit tests for my own Terraform code, though, which I haven't found a good way to do that. Yet.
Yeah, me either. It'd be cool if there was an easy way to do it. There's options that get you close, but
yeah, I've done things like where it then queries the API after and tells you if it created, but it's not all the way there. We never digress on this.
Yeah. No, I'd like something that virtualizes the state.
Yeah.
Like, so it takes your config and then has a make believe state, and then it doesn't actually deploy anything in your cloud. Like, I would love that.
Have you guys looked at Kitchen Terraform at all?
You know, I don't know about that one.
That's the tool I think I've used. I don't know if it was no, it wasn't Kitchen Terraform.
So I mean, Kitchen was the one that we used.
Chef.
Yeah, Kitchen Chef I played the Kitchen Terraform a little bit because it's Ruby and I like Ruby. But you know, it seems like it solves some of what you're looking for, but maybe not the virtualized state. Yeah, I playing the part of Peter is Justin.
I don't even know what to say right now. Words.
Yeah. Okay.
I think we played with this at one point, and it wasn't all the way there yet. But I haven't played with it in probably a couple of years now.
Well, something
also dry. Just Ruby Gem Hell is all I can think of.
Yeah, I have scars.
Who doesn't love Ruby Gem Hell? It's the best. It's the best. It's no worse than CPAN for Perl or for NPM for Node.js. Like, it's got its own wrinkles. You get used to it.
Every language has their own package management hell. Just Gem Hell is more fun.
Gem Hell, I don't know why. Gem Hell seems harder than. I mean, I haven't used CPAN. Definitely, I remember those days suck, but I don't use that anymore for a good reason.
But we don't use Ruby Gems anymore for good reason too. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, then you also had the different versions of Ruby, so you had to do the Ruby ENV,
the RVM. RVM.
RVM. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And then switch it. Where now I just would do different containers for it and deal with it that way. But back then it was like having to switch it all and hating everyone.
When RVM first came out, man, that was revolutionary.
I'm not disagreeing with it.
But now I just use a container. I wouldn't fuck
with it. Well, like Terraform has TFENV, which is great too. So you just switch the binary and swap it out in the same way. So,
all right. And then our last story is brought to you by Matt. So if you don't like it, complain to Matt. The general availability of a load balancer feature in Azure API management is here along with a new circuit breaker functionality. Customers can now effortlessly create pools of backends and efficiently distribute the load across multiple endpoints. By establishing backend pools, users can seamlessly balance the load across various backends when integrating multiple backends for an API. Innovation allows customers to spread the load across multiple backends, each equipped with an individual backend circuit breaker, ensuring optimal performance and resilience. And the circuit breaker, properly when implemented within a backend resources, protects the backend resources from overload due to excessive requests. This allows customers to set specific rules for when the circuit breaker activates, including thresholds for failure occurrences within defined timeframes, identification of specific status codes indicating failure to your logs.
If anyone's ever deployed IP tables to drop all the packets on the application server in an emergency. I like features like this because it's, I've had to figure out how to do this without the tooling. And I would like to just have a configuration property that says, we start returning 502s over this amount, just stop sending more requests, it ain't gonna work. I like it.
And it's also nice in the cloud, where it's service A talks to service B, so if it's an app service or any sort of other service that sits behind the APIM, and then the APIM might have something else in front of it, or if it's public or whatever you have, it gives you that you're not DDoSing your entire stack. From here, it's a breakpoint early, which is why I really like the circuit breaker feature. Mm-hmm. So it helps a little bit with diagnostics, like you said too.
Yeah, and circuit breaker store is good. Definitely recommend. I have Oracle announcements. You guys love a good Oracle announcement, don't you?
Of course I do.
Yep. Well, first, they're giving you a new IP address insights on OCI. This free service enables you to monitor and manage your IP addresses on OCI by providing a regional view of IP address usage for V4 and V6 IP addresses across your tenancy with hierarchical visibility into virtual cloud networks, subnets, and resources. And the only handy thing about this is I can finally get rid of all of my terrible IP platforms if I'm on Oracle.
Well, stay tuned next week where Oracle announces charging you through the nose for all of your IPv4 addresses.
It's free. It's free for the first year. Then after that, you'll find out.
Yeah. Oh, the tool is free. They'll give you an insight to the usage. But if you want another IP, that'll be $400.
Oh, yeah. Oh, your subnet is full on the VCN? I'm sorry. That's going to cost you double. Yeah. we want you to have visibility now so you can start negotiating with us now before you need them. Because then we feel like we need a discount, which we want.
Well, they need you to negotiate with them now so they can actually have the capacity in their trucks.
Well, that
in the region.
They got to get another freight truck there to drive around. Yeah. The OCI network load balancer is also getting enhanced this week, copying Microsoft. The OCI network load balancer has always supported backends in its local region. The backend can be in the same VCN or virtual cloud network as the network load balancer or a different VCN connected to the network load balancer by the local peering gateway. But now Oracle is expanding this capability to support connect a load balancer to anywhere reachable by the network load balancer through an OCI dynamic routing gateway. This allows for new scenarios, including cross VCN connectivity, cross regional support, and on-premise backends or on Azure backends if you're using the hybrid.
Yeah, it could be anything. I've never actually used these features, but I do love them, right? Like I love the idea of being able to, think about a cloud migration strategy where you configure your pools and two different locations.
I would love to be able to use this on a cloud migration strategy. The dreams I have of the day I can use it for that capability. Like, oh, I'm going to do a migration. I'm going to use this simple backend load balancer routing capability and some replication on the database. And we're going to just do this overnight. Like, I can't.
Right. And it would just, you just, you know, point it all one dynamic gateway and it just maps traffic and you just configure it to failover traffic seamlessly. What could go wrong? It's like, I would love to do that. But yeah, no, I've never been able to actually make
it. Yeah. It seems like using, like, you know, cloud migration tools that like are supposed to make it easy to plan your migration. Like, I'd like to use those too. Like,
that'd be nice. Once have that happen. It's always these weird edge cases. Blows up the whole thing.
Yeah.
Come on, a simple P to V migration. What could possibly go wrong? Or V to V?
V to V is the way to go. You know, or you could do the V to container. That's always a fun migration too. Where you overload your container with a bunch of prereqs. It's a fun model.
I've only ever seen a container be like 30 gigs. What could possibly be wrong with that?
30 gigs? That clearly wasn't a Windows container.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that was a Linux container. That was the problem.
That's a pretty big Linux container. And then the final story from Oracle is instance security is now available to you in Oracle CloudGuard. This instance security capability in CloudGuard aggregates important security information about compute instances such as security alerts, vulnerabilities, and the open ports. Instance Security provides new Oracle managed out-of-the-box detections and customer managed queries that they can use for threat hunting. Plus, customers can connect their own security information and event management, or SIM. We had a good magic quadrant earlier if you were looking for one. Or a cloud security posture management solution, also not provided by Oracle, with OCI logging to ingest data collected via agents. So I would like you to connect this to your SIM on Azure or Google, because that'd just be funny to me.
There are so many cloud security posture management tools out there at this point. Everyone's like, oh, we now have this.
Yeah, security tool saturation is rough. Like, it's funny, even researching options, like when you have a security question, it's like a whole bunch of sponsored posts and, you know, like, read our white paper and enter your email here. We'll just call you for the rest of eternity.
But even like what you like once knew was a security tool for this thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you go to the website, I'm like, okay, I think this company does this thing. I'm like, well, they've changed the marketing so many times now that I don't know which marketing buzzword they're actually trying to say is the thing that they originally did. So I have no idea what product they're actually trying to sell me. It's a fun thing. I do have to say the instance security UI for this was clearly made by an intern. It is the most boring UI I've ever possibly seen in my entire life. I'm like, what, did you just use the default JVM UI library? And we're like, here, we have a UI. Thanks. Oh, it's so boring.
Perfect. It's my kind of UI. I like it.
Yeah. I mean, at least the announcing IP address insights UI is also terrible, but at least it has graphs and lines that move back and forth. Ooh,
lines.
A pie chart. And so, like, you know, my executive brain likes that one.
I was going to say, you're setting me up. Yeah.
Indeed.
Got to give Justin his pictures.
I want my graphs. that is it for another fantastic week here in the cloud, and we'll see what else comes out of Build. If anything else good comes out of it, we'll talk about it next week. And then
spoiler, it'll be AI related.
It's gonna be AI. Yep. I did see after cutoff that OpenAI was on stage, which is sort of interesting because they're in trouble with Scarlett Johansson. Like, who wants to alienate Scarlett Johansson? Come on, like, don't copy her voice from her to be your AI for the new voice thing. Like, what a dumb move.
That is crazy. I was reading an article where they asked her to do it and she declined. I'm like, ooh, bold move. Then just copy it anyway.
Yeah. So you declined it. So then you basically created a voice inflection that's very similar to hers. And then you just tweaked it just a scoosh. So you can be like, it's not exactly the same as hers, but it's the same inflections, the same like cadence. Like, I like to see this one go through court.
Mm-hmm. Didn't work for Vanilla Ice. It's not going to work for them.
Yep. All right, guys. See you next week here on the Cloud Pod.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
And that's the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank this week's sponsor, Sunry. Check out a 14-day free trial at sunry.co/cloudpod. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can check out our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet at us with hashtag #poundthecloudpod.